I spent years chasing the fastest way to get things done. I bought the loudest machines and the most expensive gadgets because I thought speed was the same thing as success. But the first time a storm knocked out the power for a week, I realized how fragile my efficiency really was. I had a shed full of tools that wouldn't start and a freezer full of food that was melting. That was the day I changed my mind about what it means to be productive. Now I look for the simplest path instead of the fastest one. True capability is not about how many acres you can clear in an hour. It is about knowing that you can still provide for yourself when the world gets very quiet. This guide is about the tools and the methods that do not break. It is about the peace of mind that comes from doing things by hand. Chapter 1. The Scythe and the Stone. I remember the first morning I walked out into the tall grass with nothing but a long wooden handle and a curved blade. The dew was still heavy on the stalks, and the air was cool enough to see my breath. For years I used a gas-powered trimmer for this job. It was loud, and it vibrated so hard my hands would go numb after 20 minutes. But that morning, I wanted something different. I wanted to hear the birds, and I wanted to feel the ground beneath my boots without the smell of exhaust hanging in the air. Scope and safety. The scope of manual hay cutting is deceptively simple. You are using a tool called a scythe to harvest forage or clear a field. It is a quiet process, but it requires a deep respect for the edge of the blade. Safety starts with your stance. You must keep your feet planted firmly and move your body in a pendulum motion from the hips. Never pull the blade toward your feet. Always keep the tip of the blade pointed slightly up to avoid catching a rock or a hidden stump. If you are working with others, you must stay at least 20 feet apart. A scythe blade is a razor on a stick, and it does not care if it is cutting grass or leather boots. Tools and materials. To do this right, you need a snath, which is the wooden or metal handle, and a blade suited for your grass type. A grass blade is long and thin for easy cutting, while a bush blade is shorter and heavier for thick weeds. You also need a whetstone and a galvanized bucket of water. You must keep the stone wet while you work. I also keep a small hammer and an anvil in my kit for peening. This is the process of cold hammering the edge to keep it thin. It is a skill that takes time to learn, but it is the secret to a blade that cuts like a whisper. The steps. First you set your blade. The angle must be just right for your height. I stand with my feet shoulder-width apart and start the swing from my right side. You do not hack at the grass, you slice it. The blade stays flat against the ground and moves in a wide arc. As I turn my torso, the blade glides through the stalks. The grass falls in a neat pile to the left, which we call a windrow. This makes it easy to collect later for the animals. Every 5 or 10 minutes I stop to hone the edge. I wipe the blade clean with a handful of grass and then run the wet stone along the metal. Checks and fixes. If you feel the blade pulling or if you have to use force, you are doing it wrong. The most common fix is sharpening. If the blade is sharp but it still feels heavy, check the mounting hardware. The ring that holds the blade to the snath can vibrate loose. Always carry a small wrench or a screwdriver to tighten it. If you hit a rock, check the edge for nicks immediately. You can often file out a small nick in the field, but a large one requires a trip back to the bench. Care and maintenance. When the work is done, I never just lean the scythe against a wall. I wipe the metal with a light coat of vegetable oil to prevent rust. I store it high up on a rack where the kids or the dogs cannot run into it. The wooden handle needs a coat of linseed oil once a season, so it does not crack in the sun. Why it matters. We do this because simplicity is a form of insurance. When you rely on a machine, you are relying on a global supply chain for parts and fuel. When you rely on a scythe, you are relying on your own shoulders and a piece of stone. It teaches you the rhythm of your land. You notice the small flowers and the nests that a mower would destroy. It turns a chore into a meditation. There is a deep sense of capability that comes from knowing you can feed your livestock using nothing but the energy of your own body. The rhythm of the blade becomes the rhythm of the heart. Chapter 2. Gravity and the Well. I woke up during the ice storm of 2024 to a house that was completely silent. The hum of the refrigerator was gone, and the well pump in the basement was dead. Without electricity, the water stopped flowing. I had hundreds of gallons of water sitting right under my feet, but I couldn't touch a drop of it. That was the last time I relied solely on an electric pump. Now when I walk out to the well house, I see the tall red handle of my manual backup pump. It stands there like a silent sentry, ready to work no matter what the weather does. Scope and safety. This chapter covers the installation and use of a manual deep well pump alongside your existing system. The scope includes moving water from a static source to a storage tank or a trough. Safety is paramount when dealing with wellheads. You must ensure the cap is sealed to prevent surface runoff from contaminating your drinking water. Always follow local health codes regarding well seals. When operating a hand pump, be mindful of the kickback on the handle if the vacuum is strong. Use your legs to pump and keep your back straight to avoid strain. Tools and materials. A manual pump system requires a pump head, a series of drop pipes, and a cylinder that sits below the water level. Inside that cylinder is a leather or rubber gasket called a leather set. You will also need pipe wrenches, Teflon tape, and a tripod if you are pulling the pipe yourself. For the livestock, I use a gravity-fed system which requires black poly pipe and a float valve. Having a few spare leather gaskets on hand is essential because they are the only part of the system that truly wears out. The steps to get water. I first prime the pump. If it has been sitting dry, I pour a clean cup of water into the top to swell the leathers. Then I begin a long, steady stroke. You can't rush a hand pump. You have to wait for the air to be displaced. Once the water catches, you will feel the weight on the handle. I fill 5-gallon buckets and carry them to the kitchen, or I hook up the hose that leads to the upper pasture. Because the storage tank is on a hill, the water flows down to the troughs, using nothing but gravity. I don't need a motor to move it once it is out of the ground. Checks and fixes. If you are pumping and getting no resistance, the leathers are likely worn or dried out. You have to pull the top of the pump and replace the seal. It is a 30-minute job that anyone can do with a wrench. If the water comes out cloudy, let it run for a few minutes. This often happens if the well has not been used recently. If the handle becomes impossible to move, check for a frozen pipe in the winter. I wrap my pump head in wool blankets and a wooden box to prevent this. Care and maintenance. Every spring I pull the handle and grease the pivot points. I check the bolts that hold the pump to the well casing. I also test the water once a year for bacteria. The most important maintenance is simply using it. A pump that sits idle will fail faster than one that works every day. The moving parts need to stay lubricated by the water itself. Why it matters. Water is the foundation of the homestead. Without it, you have no garden and no animals. Relying on the grid for your water makes you a tenant on your own land. When you install a manual system, you are taking back your sovereignty. It takes more physical effort to pump by hand, but that effort creates a direct connection to the resource. You stop wasting water because you know exactly how much work it took to get it. It turns a basic need into a conscious act of stewardship. The well runs deep, but my reach is longer. Chapter 3. The Root Cellar Philosophy. There is a specific smell to a good root cellar that you can't find anywhere else. It is the smell of damp earth and cold stone and the sweet earthy scent of curing potatoes. Last October, I stood in my cellar and looked at the rows of bins filled with the summer's hard work. Outside, the wind was starting to bite, but down here, the temperature was a steady 50 degrees. I didn't have to worry about a power outage ruining my winter food supply. I didn't have to worry about a motor burning out. The earth itself was doing the work of preservation. Scope and safety. The scope of a root cellar is the long-term storage of hardy vegetables and fruits without the use of electricity. We use the thermal mass of the ground to regulate temperature. Safety in a cellar is mostly about air quality and structural integrity. You must have a vent to allow carbon dioxide and ethylene gas to escape. If you are building a subsurface cellar, ensure the ceiling is properly reinforced to handle the weight of the dirt above. Always check for mold or rot. One bad apple really will spoil the whole bushel if the air is stagnant. Tools and materials. You need sturdy wooden bins made of rot-resistant wood, like cedar or white oak. Avoid treated lumber, which can off-gas chemicals into your food. I use galvanized mesh on the vents to keep out rodents. For certain crops like carrots and parsnips, you need clean, damp sand or sawdust to pack them in. A simple hygrometer and a thermometer are the only tech items you need. They tell you if you need to crack the vent or add a bucket of water to the floor to increase the humidity. The steps harvesting for the cellar is different than harvesting for the table. I wait for a dry day and I never wash the vegetables. I gently brush off the loose dirt and let them cure in a cool, dark place for a few days to toughen the skins. Then I sort them. The bruised ones go to the kitchen for immediate use. The perfect ones go into the bins. I put the potatoes in the darkest corner and the onions in a drier spot near the door. I bury the root crops in layers of sand, making sure they do not touch each other. Checks and fixes. Every Saturday morning, I walk the bins. I look for any signs of softening or sprouts. If a potato feels mushy, I remove it immediately. If the cellar feels too dry, I sprinkle a little water on the dirt floor. If it feels too damp, I open the vent for an hour. If I see evidence of a mouse, I check the perimeter for holes and patch them with steel wool and mortar. The cellar is a living environment, and it requires a watchful eye, care, and maintenance. In the late spring, when the bins are empty, I clean the whole space. I sweep out the old sand and scrub the shelves with a mixture of vinegar and water. I leave the door open on dry days to air it out completely. This prevents the buildup of spores that could ruin next year's crop. I also check the drainage pipes to make sure they aren't clogged with roots or debris. Why it matters: a root cellar is the ultimate expression of homesteading simplicity. It is a passive system that works with the laws of thermodynamics rather than fighting against them. Modern freezers are amazing until they stop working. A root cellar doesn't stop working. It provides a level of food security that a grocery store never can. When you eat a carrot in February that you pulled from the ground in October, you are tasting your own foresight. It closes the loop of the seasons and proves that the old ways are often the most resilient ways. The earth keeps what the summer gives.